Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams, our co-host. Daniel, good to see you today.
How are this morning, Dr. Paul?
I'm doing fine,
Excellent. Ready
and raring to go, and especially because we have a special guest today.
Yes,
very
we do.
Special guest, well-known, and he's going to talk a little bit about the subject we've been talking about. We'll be talking to the expert about vaccines and other things. But our guest is a graduate of Harvard University and University of Virginia, has a law degree, teaches, and very much interested in environmental things and litigation against people who don't take care of our environment. And he's spent a lot of time in that. But he's also become known a person of indeed a lot of interest in the vaccine. Robert Kennedy, we welcome you to the program.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Paul.
Well, good. No, we have a lot of questions for you, so we can flip a coin and take something. But I'm going to start off with something that I've thought a lot about, and you get a lot of questions about, and it's just something before we get into the vaccines, and that is the very, very difficult situations that the Kennedy family had to go through. And I've read most of the books about assassinations and problems, and the viewers are very interested in that. Could you give us a little bit of an idea? Because, for libertarians, the CIA, we're always a little suspicious of. Is there anything that you can say about that? How do you psychologically handle that? Or what are your concerns? I'm sure there's a lot of things you think about that are not factual yet, but you certainly made an effort to try to find out the truth about your dad's killing. And we really respect you for that.
Well, I wrote a book about this and kind of my journey. It's called American Values. And it's really about my family's 50-year, or actually now about 75-year battle with the CIA. And that fight actually started in the mid-1950s when Truman had asked my grandfather, Joseph Kennedy, to serve on a commission called the Hoover Commission that was chaired by President Hoover to look at the CIA and its role, because, as you know, the CIA, when it was originally chartered, was not chartered to engage in sort of paramilitary activities and fixing elections and murdering leaders and interfering with the business and democracies in other countries. And it was founded and created and with great reluctance from both Republicans and Democrats, because it was thought after World War II, we had an OSS during World War II, and after World War II, OSS was liquidated, because the belief was that secret police organizations were inconsistent with democratic ideals, democracies, with constitutional governance. And that they would grow and that they would end up enveloping and subverting democracy. And, when Americans thought of secret police, they thought of the Stasi, they thought of the KGB, they thought of the Gestapo. And they said, and there were debates about this in Congress when we were originally launching the CIA. And both Republicans and Democrats said, this is not something we should be doing. But when they started it exclusively as an espionage organization, which meant spying. Mm-hmm. It meant intelligence gathering. It did not mean interfering. And so then, Alan Dulles, kind of manipulated the law and did a lot of kind of backroom deals to get these huge secret budgets and began really engaging in all of the mischief. And my grandfather was on a commission that looked at this and saw what they had done in, when they were overthrowing democracies in Guatemala and Iran and all over the world. And he said, we should dismantle it. We should remove the plans division, which was the dirty tricks division, from espionage. And Alan Dulles never forgave him or my family for that. And then when my uncle came in and did the Bay of Pigs, well, and then fired Dulles. I always believed that, even from when I was a little kid, when President Johnson came into the room in the East Room of the White House I was standing beside my father when he said to my father that, that Lee Harvey Oswald had just been killed by Jack Ruby. He told my father and Jackie that. And I said to my father, I said, did Jack Ruby love our family? And nobody answered that question. You know, later my father did his own research and found out that he was connected to the mob and to the CIA and to all these. My father's initial belief was the CIA had killed his brother. I always believe that, and I think you'd be an idiot not to believe what the congressional investigation found out in 85, which is President Kennedy was killed by a conspiracy. But I never believed that about my dad. And I just believed that Sirhan, evidence against him was overwhelming and he had confessed to the crime. There was evidence found in his room. And then Paul Schrade, who was one of my dad's best friends and who was standing beside my father when he was shot, and Paul took a bullet to his head at that time. He took the first of Sirhan's bullets. And he said to me, your father was not killed by Sirhan. And I need you to look at the autopsy report and look at this evidence. And as a favor, I did not want to do that. I didn't want to get into all the conspiracy theories. But as a favor to Paul, because he was such a hero, he was the one who introduced my dad to Cesar Chavez. He was the number two guy at the United Auto Workers and was just a stalwart, friend of our families. I went to his house in LA, outside of LA, and I sat down with him for a couple of days. I went through the autopsy report, all this other stuff. And by the end of that, it was clear to me that Sirhan could not have killed my father.
Wow.
And my father was killed by four shots that were all fired from behind him. Sirhan fired two shots. He was across a steam table. He never got behind my father. My father was always facing him. He was 6 to 10 feet away. And Sirhan fired two shots. The first one hit Paul Schrade. The second one hit a door jamb behind my father, right past his head, and hit a door jamb. And then he was grabbed by Rosie Greer, Rafer Johnson, and all these other people. And there was a dog pile, and they took the gun hand and they pointed it away from my father, but they couldn't get the gun from him. He fired six more shots, and all of those shots hit people. So we know where the shots all landed. There were 14 shots fired, and his gun only had 8. It was a revolver with 8 chambers in it. It never reloaded. So. And the 4 shots that hit my dad all came from behind, and Thomas Noguchi, who was the greatest coroner in American history, his finding is that every one of those was contact shots, that the barrel of the gun was touching my father at the time they were fired, and they were fired from behind at an upward angle. I think the guy who probably pulled the trigger is a guy called Eugene Thayne Caesar, who was a CIA agent. He worked for Lockheed. He was working that night as a security guard. He had gotten the job 4 days before.
Wow.
He was waiting for my father in the kitchen. And when my father went through the Ambassador Hotel kitchen, he grabbed him by his right arm or his left arm and was standing behind him when the shots were fired. And he had pulled his own gun, which was also a .22. And he was seen, and he admitted that he had pulled his gun. But he said, and my father, when my father fell, he fell onto Caesar. And, if you look at the MK Ultra manual about, they have a whole section that the CIA was experimenting on creating these Manchurian candidates. And what the psychiatrists who were working for them said is that it took them a year to turn somebody into a Manchurian candidate, somebody who would actually commit a murder involuntarily.
Right.
But they said they could make a distractor in 3 months, and they could make it out of anybody.
Okay, Daniel, we didn't allot for a couple hours, but we could really use a couple hours. This is a great interview. Robert, I want to ask you, a long time ago when I first got interested in politics, before I ever went to Congress, some of these things were interesting to me. And I was talking to an old-line conservative constitutionalist, and he was well-known at that time. And he said to me, he says, you know, he had been somebody that spent time in the FBI and knew how the CIA originated. And he told me something. It seems like you lean toward maybe agreeing with it. He told me, he says, Ron, he says, you know, if you have a CIA, it's incompatible with a republic. And I didn't know exactly what he was saying, but over the years, I think I've come to that agreement. Is that too radical of a statement, or would you certainly lean in that direction?
I mean, what I would say, I would go even further, which is that you cannot have a nation that is, and this is what our founders said, you know, this is just the wisdom of the ages. You cannot have an imperial nation abroad and have a democracy at home.
Wow.
They're incompatible with each other. Yes. If you may allow your nation, this is what the Romans did, you know. Romans were a republic for the first 200 years, but then they became a dictatorship because they became an imperial, you know, nation. And but this is, you look all around the world, the Spanish Empire, the British Empire, etc.
Robert, and really the books I've read have indicated that both your uncle and your father had opinions that were contradictory to those who thought we ought to be around the world and might have been part of the reasons that the assassinations occurred.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. My uncle, 2 months before his death, he signed National Security Order 237, which ordered all troops out of Vietnam, the first 1,000. He only had 16,000 advisors there. He never put combat troops in. He was surrounded by militarists who were telling him, you got to put a 250,000 American troops in there. And he said, I'm not going to do it. And the day he left for Dallas, he asked his aide for a report about American mortalities among the advisors, mainly Green Berets, helicopter pilots who were in Vietnam. And there had been 75 men killed. And he was horrified. And he said, that's too many. This is not worth one American life. I want them all out. He signed a national security order. Okay. Bring the first 1,000 men home by December of that year. He was killed in November.
Wow.
And bring 100% of them home by the following December.
Wow.
And he was killed a few days after that.
Yeah. You know, the one thing that we want to do, we want to talk about the vaccines. And you have written a lot, and you've been criticized, and you have been praised all along on vaccines. And of course, as a physician and somebody involved in politics and all, I've been fascinated with too, because I've seen some things that happen with vaccination. How did you get your interest in that? Because you're a known expert and have been working on this for a long time. It isn't like last month with coronavirus came up, you studied it and started speaking out. How did you originally get involved in vaccinations?
I run the biggest water protection group in the world, and it's called Waterkeeper Alliance. I started out working for fishermen on the Hudson River in 1984. They had a small group of commercial fishermen whose livelihoods were being destroyed by pollution, and I began litigating, suing polluters on the river, and I ended up bringing over 500 lawsuits on the Hudson and forcing polluters to spend almost $5 billion. The Hudson today is the richest waterway in the North Atlantic. It's an international model for ecosystem protection and restoration. It produces more pounds of fish per acre, more biomass per gallon than any other waterway in the Atlantic Ocean north of the equator. The miraculous resurrection of the Hudson inspired the creation of river keepers on waterways all over North America and then all over the world. So now we own the Waterkeeper name, Riverkeeper, Soundkeeper, Baykeeper, etc. We license these groups to get started. I run the umbrella group, which is called Waterkeeper Alliance. We have 350 waterkeepers. Each one has a patrol boat. They patrol local waterways and they sue polluters. In 2003, the FDA published a study, a multi-year study, that showed that every freshwater fish in America had dangerous levels of mercury in its flesh. And it struck me then, Dr. Paul, that we were living in a science fiction nightmare. My children and the children of every other American could now no longer engage in the seminal primal activity of American youth, which is to go fishing with their mom or dad in the local fishing hole and then come home and safely fish. So a lot of the water keepers began suing the principal source for that mercury, coal-burning power plants and cement kilns. In 2005, I had 40 lawsuits against mainly coal-burning power plants in the states, the United States, and the provinces of Canada. And I was traveling all over North America, giving speeches about mercury, promoting legislation, and explaining the litigation, et cetera. And whenever I started talking to a large group at one of these big forums, there were always these women who would appear in the front seats. They would come early, and they would stay to the end, and they would talk to me. And they were all the mothers of intellectually disabled children. And they were all women who believed that their child had been injured by a vaccine. And they said to me in kind of a respectful but very kind of scolding way, if you are really interested in mercury exposures to children, you need to look at the vaccines. This is, Dr. Paul, something I didn't want to do. I was raised on kind of the spear tip of rights for intellectually disabled. I grew up with Special Olympics. My aunt, Una Schreier, is also my godmother, had me working at Special Olympics from when I was 8 years old as a hugger, as a coach. I spent 200 hours during high school and working in Wasatch Home for the Retarded. And I have been, my family was around that issue, as you know, from the beginning of time. It's not what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to work on water and on energy. And but one of these women came to my home in the summer of 2005. She was a psychologist from Minnesota named Sarah Bridges. Her son had gotten autism from a mercury vaccine, and he had gotten recognition of that from the vaccine court. He won the judgment, and they had given him $20 million, lifetime support. She wanted to make sure it didn't happen to anybody else, and she brought a huge pile of studies, about 18 inches thick, to my home in my little bungalow in Hyannis, Massachusetts. And she put it on my front porch. And she said, I'm not leaving here till you read these. And I'm very comfortable reading science. My whole life has been about science. All of these lawsuits that I've won, hundreds and hundreds of them, all of them involve a scientific controversy. So I'm comfortable reading science. I know how to read it critically. And I started reading these studies. I read the abstracts. And before I was 4 or 5 inches deep in that pile, I was just dumbstruck about the huge delta between what the public health agencies were telling us about vaccine safety and what the actual published peer-reviewed science was saying.
Yeah.
That really was my, that's how I started down this wormhole and ruined my career and my life, by the way, because it was not a good career choice for me. As you know, it's not a popular subject.
Well, my first introduction legally or a campaign or with legislatively, I was first elected in 76. And there was a swine flu, and there were two of us that voted against this inoculation, which turned out, I'm sure you know about how badly it turned out. More people died from the vaccine than they did from the flu. But anyway, politics is involved, medicine is involved. I read one place where that was not necessarily a friendly site for you, because they came up and they talked about your position believes in vaccine and autism. They said the anti-scientific position that you have on the autism and on vaccine. Well, I delivered a lot of babies, and I've seen a few bad results after they had shots. And I mean, I'm not the expert on autism and vaccines, but I tell you what, where my inquiries are and my sympathies are for with, because certainly a lot of people don't buy into the people who write that and try to paint you as anti-scientific. I know you, that's the kind of stuff you've had to put up with for a long time.
Yeah, and you know, I've written a book summarizing all the science that I thought, you know, people are saying this, of course, that, you know, the pharmaceutical cartel, which controls our public health agencies, is telling people, well, there's no proof that autism is caused by vaccines. But here's the thing. I've done a book about it, and the book, I thought this, you know, as soon as this book comes out, everybody's just going to see what the truth is, because all I did in the book was I took all the science, about 1,400 studies, many of them, about 160 of them, showing that vaccines cause autism. And I put them in one book and I summarized them with links so anybody could look them up. I got 12 reviews in the book before the book was ever circulated. So nobody read it. You know, none of the reviewers read it. Forbes and, you know, and Time Magazine and Newsweek all did reports condemning it. But here's the thing, is people should not listen to me about science. People have to do, they shouldn't, but, you know, what I say is not science. The science is what's in the published peer review. And what Tony Fauci says is not science. What CDC says is not science.
Right.
If you want the science, you got to read the peer review. And here is what the Institute of Medicine said. The Institute of Medicine is now called the National Academy of Medicine. It's a, you know, federal panel that is the ultimate arbiter of medical science. Congress and HHS appointed it and said, we want you to backstop CDC and make sure they're not cheating. So the Institute of Medicine periodically goes in and looks at every couple of years at CDC science on vaccine safety. And they've specifically looked at the issue of autism. And they have a report in 1994 in 2011, in 2013, in 2017. And all of those reports, they say to CDC, you have never studied the link between autism and vaccines. And in fact, they said in their last report, they said, when it comes, they said there's 178 conditions that we believe are being caused by this, by vaccines. Chronic diseases like diabetes, arthritis, food allergies, asthma, all of these things that have exploded since 1989. Like, you know, the vaccine generation is the generation born after 89. The sickest generation in history. Autism went from my generation from 1 in 10,000 my kids' generation, one in every 34 kids. And so the Institute of Medicine looked at 178 chronic diseases that are now afflicting this generation. 54% of the kids have chronic diseases. In my generation, 12%. No, my generation, 6%. In the generation that was in 1986, it was 12%. These kids at 54%, and they've lost 7 IQ points.
Right. You know,
let me just finish this. The Institute of Medicine said to them, you have done no science on this. And they went through each of those conditions in each vaccine. And when they came to, and this is on page 554 of that report, they came to autism and they said, there is only one study that's ever been done about the 6 vaccines that are given. 26 shots of 6 vaccines given the first 6 months of life. Okay. That study says that the vaccines cause autism. We're not going to use that study because it was based upon CDC's system, which, you know, a data gathering system, which we think is lousy. But they said, other than that study, there's not a single study on any of those vaccines that shows that they don't cause autism. So the agencies have deliberately not done those studies. And it's not me saying it. It's not Robert Kennedy, the lawyer. It's the National Academy of Medicine that has said that.
All right. Daniel has a question for you, Robert.
Well, Mr. Kennedy, you're right. It's certainly not a wise career decision to challenge the prevailing paradigms on vaccines in particular. I can speak for my family as a father of three unvaccinated children. It's no bed of roses as a parent either. You know, we spent years being screamed at by doctors before we realized the best course of action is just to stop going because it's only a vaccine conveyor belt when you go for your checkups. But I wanted to go back to something that's a little bit more in the news, and you made some waves in your recent discussion with Alec Baldwin. You had an hour-long discussion. Something that you mentioned there stood out because it's something that Dr. Paul and I mentioned very often on our program. You made the point that the death toll from the lockdowns and from the quarantines may very well exceed the COVID deaths in our current coronavirus situation. Such a great point. I would only add to it the dangerous precedent sent that from the lowly county commissioners to all the way to the governors, that our civil liberties can be switched off at the flip of a switch, and you can't go outside anymore. So, what would you say about the lockdowns and the COVID deaths?
Well, the civil rights issue is a different issue, but what I've said is that we're listening to Anthony Fauci, who's telling us what the what COVID may do on various scenarios of lockdown. He may or may not be able to predict that accurately. But what we need a broader discussion, because we need to know not only what the benefits of lockdown on COVID mortalities is, but we need to know what the cost of lockdown is on non-COVID mortalities. And I think the data are really clear that quarantine is going to kill far more people than COVID. Mm. And there was a study back in the 1980s. Back in the 1980s, a lot of people were studying the question of the impacts of, we had big a downscaling of these huge corporations back in the early 80s. There was a whole discipline of science, an industry of science that emerged, of economics, a field of economics that looked at the impacts of unemployment on human life and other factors. And one of the most famous of those studies that has been cited everywhere said that for every 1 point in unemployment, there are 37,000 excess deaths.
Wow.
The deaths, and it enumerated where they're coming from. I think 9,000 of them were from heart attacks, 900 were from suicide. In addition, and by the way, this was at a time when our population was 43% smaller. So you need to really almost double that.
Wow.
To look at the impacts of unemployment today. In addition to that, there were 4,000 extra imprisonments and 3,300 extra admissions to mental institutions. And, if we have 30 points of unemployment, which they're predicting now, we're talking about a couple of million deaths, which is much more from the unemployment. In addition to that, we have disruptions to medical supply chains and food supply. That there are millions of people starving around the world because of the quarantine. We've lost already about 50,000 minority businesses permanently in this country. What is that going to do? There was a report from one hospital in San Francisco that said that the suicide rates, the amount of suicides they were getting in that hospital, they got in 1 month, they got a year worth of suicides, so a 1,200% increase.
Wow.
I know from my own experience that, this is really an alcohol. I read this, I don't know this from my experience. I know that a lot of people are suffering from addiction issues right now, that they're, they can't go to AA meetings, they can't go to 12-step meetings, they're locked in. Isolation does not mix with addiction, you know. And alcohol, I read this, and I can't cite it, but anybody can look this up and check me on it. But alcohol sales are up 600%.
Wow.
Oh, in England, isolation kills people too. In England, and this is true, there's a similar study in Italy. England looked at during 5 weeks in April and May, they looked at deaths in what they call elder care facilities. We call them nursing homes. They said there are 30,000 excess deaths, but only 10,000 of them were from COVID. 20,000 of them were from people, you know, who didn't get their dialysis, who didn't get their heart medicine, who were isolated, who couldn't get to a doctor when they had a complaint.
Yeah.
And they ended up dying. And people deferred cancer checks, all of these things have come back to haunt us. Let me just say one other thing, because it's my party that is pushing more than I think the Republican is, not exactly partisan, but it's much more the Democrats that are pushing the quarantine. And I really think it's going to come back and hurt all the values that my party has represented for forever. We are dismantling the New Deal now. All of that, you know, all the people that we got health care reform for under Obamacare, there's been 16 million Americans who have lost health care since the beginning of those. That's going to be a tremendous number of deaths, probably more than COVID.
Yeah.
And then, you know, all the other programs to pay for this $3 trillion debt that we're running up, how is that going to pay? I've been through, and you've been through, periods in our country when the states are scrambling to pay their debt. They can't put off the debt like the U.S. government has there. You know, they have constitutional provisions that make them live within their budget. And the only way for them to do that is to fire teachers, to stop school lunch programs, to end sports programs at school, to end constrict special education. Mm-hmm. We're already seeing that happening. We're going to see the destruction of all the New Deal programs of unemployment, of Medicaid, of Medicare, of Social Security. And you're going to see a huge shift in wealth from the obliterated middle class in our country to the very, very rich. And we're already seeing that. Richest billionaires in this country.
Robert, you may call yourself a Democrat, but you sound pretty independent-minded to me. And we have a follow-up question.
I was just going to add to what you were saying about, and it's even worse when they start opening up, because look what's happening in the schools. They're basically opening up fire hoses of disinfectant and spraying these schools down. These poor kids, they are mostly immune to this. We know that. We have the data. They're going to be sprayed with God knows what kinds of chemicals on their bodies to disinfect these schools. So it's almost worse for these poor kids going back to school.
And I think also, you know, a kid in this country, the death rate among children for flu is higher than the death rate for coronavirus. Yeah. For children. So the death rate, the risk for a child, somebody who's under 20 years old, of dying from coronavirus is zero. Now, you know, there's a couple of kids where it's happened and they headline them and they're on the news all the time. But the mathematical, the mathematical risk to those children is zero.
Right.
And so then the question becomes, what do you, you know, are we going to force these kids to live, to make huge sacrifices in their lives in order, including taking a vaccine, to protect older people? That is a very dicey ethical issue. Are we going to sacrifice these kids to, you know, because there's some hypothetical benefit to older people? And it's true in their schools that, you know, the one, I think, real concern is the teachers. You know, are they going to get sick? But I think that, you know, the risk that we're imposing on these kids now of teaching them that they're, you know, they can't hug their friends, that, you know, other human beings are biohazards, that they should be scared of them. You know, Ron, we're supposed to be the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Right.
And, you know, Franklin Roosevelt said during World War II, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And the reason he said that is because he saw that fear was the instrument of tyranny and authoritarian rule. And in Germany and in Spain and Italy, the tyrannical leaders had used that fear of the Great Depression to end democracy and to, you know, go to fascism. In Russia, leaders had used fear to go into, you know, communism. So Roosevelt did something different. He said, we're not going to be scared. We're going to stand together, and we're going to go through this, and we are not going to give in to fear. That's the only thing we're going to fear, because we're going to get through this.
Right. You know,
as long as we're not scared. And he preserved democracy, and he preserved constitutional government. And, you know, he did that by avoiding fear. And now we have all these politicians and the press, which, of course, addicted to pharma.
Okay, I'm going to finish up, but I want to get your opinion on what the odds of us solving some of these problems. Because we, as libertarians, want voluntary solutions. Two people get together and voluntary, anybody mess up, they're liable. The other option is authoritarianism and mandates. Of course, we see in a lot of it, and the Faucis and the Gates of the world are the authoritarians, and they dictate. But then you say, well, they'll be liable. No, the Congress exempts them from their liability. So how are we going to change that mentality, which is what we face up to? We think we have a lead on what we should do, but you put your effort up. But do you have days that you're less optimistic than other days? Because I think that's basically what has to change is the people's attitude and dependency on being taken care of, provide everything, and then remove the liability of the people who are making all the money.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not optimistic or pessimistic because I think either of those is a trap. I get up and I go to work in the morning and I'm going to fight this. I know it's right. I know it's wrong. And I'm going to fight for what I know is right. And, you know, if I have to, I'll die with my boots on, but I'm not going to, but I'm going to keep fighting them. And I think we're going to win ultimately. I think we're going to beat them in court and we're going to beat them on the streets. But it's going to be, you know, this is like an apocalyptical battle. You know, it's really something I never thought it would happen in my lifetime. But all the values of our country are being eroded and subverted. And, you know, we've been through, listen, in 1969, we had a bird flu pandemic in this country. And it had a higher death rate than COVID. 100,000 Americans died. That's when we had half the population. And we all went to Woodstock. Nobody wore, you know, we went to Woodstock, and it wasn't in the press. It was part of life.
Yeah.
And, it's all about perception ultimately. And, you know, this is being used as, you know, this biosecurity agenda, which they've been pushing for so many years, is now the dominant agenda. Of course, it's the biggest tool for authoritarianism because, you know, as Goebbels said this, Goebbels said it at Nuremberg. He said, how did you get the German people to move like sheep, to do whatever you said? You know, and he said, it's easy. You know, it doesn't have to be a fascist government. It can be in a monarchy, a democracy. It doesn't matter. You use fear. He said, if you tell the people, point to something and said, be scared of that, and I'm the only one who can save you, they will do anything you tell them to do. And so for many years, we've been pointing at the communists and said, you got to behave here at home because they're going to get you or whatever. Now they've got something, this, you know, fear of this disease, which gives them a power that no tyrant in history ever had, where they can shut down the entire nation. They can tell you, don't go to the beach, don't go near your girlfriend, don't go hiking, it's crazy. And, you know, it's not proportional. It is not proportional to the threat. And that's what I don't like about it. I like risk assessments.
There you go.
Where, you know, people actually are fearful of things they ought to be fearful of, but you know, you don't walk around fearful of lightning all the time.
Well, we're on our way. We'll keep plugging away. And what we enjoyed so much about having you on, Robert, is I think it brings people together. No, we don't have all the agreements all the way down to the Michelin. But for something like this, which is really, really a serious problem, to build alliances, we need them, because there's no one person going to get up and say, this is what you're going to do. So I want to express my deep appreciation and our program deep appreciation for you being with us today.